From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Waitress moms, Walmart moms, and undecided voters. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The president and Mitt Romney are dashing from swing state to swing state in pursuit of this year's last undecided voters. Polls show they are women, especially white, non-college-educated, working women, not the soccer moms of the prosperous 1990s. Obama accuses Romney of conducting a war on women, but they've been moving in Romney's direction since after the first debate. Are they more concerned about abortion and contraception or the economy? How does micro-targeting help the candidate speak to the different needs of different women? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To The Point. With the campaign down to a few precious days, the last few undecided voters are said to be women. We'll find out who they are, where they live, and how neatly they do or don't fit into categories like waitress moms and Walmart moms. Whatever happened to soccer moms? On Reporter's Notebook, why are traditional auto dealers suing electric car maker Tesla just for opening its own stores? First, this news update. The Commerce Department today released one of the last important sources of economic data before the November election. It shows an increasing growth rate with different degrees of optimism from consumers and business. Kevin Hall reports on economics for the McClatchy newspapers. Good to have you as always.
Thank you.
So the last quarter, it was a 1.3% growth rate. What about the next quarter?
We went up to 2% in the third quarter, an annual rate. So it's an acceleration. It's not... Under normal times, a 2% growth rate in a mature economy like ours would be a healthy thing. But given that we're coming back from the Great Recession and continue to struggle with keeping this forward momentum, it's less than desirable.
What about consumer spending?
Consumer spending was the high point in this. It was a bit of a disconnect, and it really comes through in the numbers that consumers they accounted for about 1.2% of the change or the growth. They were a big percentage points, I should say. And they were a big power force, and that's kind of going back to pre-crisis levels in terms of the consumer being such a big role in the economy. So that's a good sign. But the bad sign is businesses scaled back their investment in large part because they're worried about the fiscal cliff.
Wasn't there an upsurge in home construction?
Home construction is also up in home sales, and that's for the first time in quite some time, housing actually added to growth rather than subtracted. But housing, because of the severity of the crisis, housing is a much smaller percentage of our economy now than it was, say, in 2005. Still welcome, and it's anything that pulls us forward instead of drags us backward is a good thing. So, you know, President Obama, for instance, can now point to the housing and can point to an acceleration going into the election and certainly see things are getting better. Mitt Romney has quickly said this is unacceptable, this is subpar, and this is just another quarter of subpar growth after several quarters of subpar growth.
Talking with Kevin Hall with the McClatchy newspapers, as you indicated, Mitt Romney was very quick to throw cold water on the report. He was during a prearranged speech that he was making in Ohio.
Today we received, by the way, the latest round of discouraging economic news. Last quarter, our economy grew at just 2%. After the stimulus was passed, the White House promised that the economy would now be growing at 4.3%, over twice as fast. Slow economic growth means slow job growth and declining take-home pay.
Again, that was in Ames, Iowa, not in Ohio. The Obama campaign immediately responded. Adam Fletcher, a spokesman for the president said Romney's hiding the truth because he knows his plans would punish the middle class and take us back to the same failed policies that crushed the economy and created record job losses in the first place. There's a clear economic choice in this election, and the American people want to move forward, not back. Back to Kevin Hall. When are we going to see any more in the way of economic figures that might have an impact on the campaign?
Well, next Friday we have the monthly jobs report for September, for October rather, and that's going to be a very important number. I don't think there's anybody out there who thinks it's going to be a stellar number. So if it comes in the anywhere from $70,000 to $140,000. All of that is possible. Any of that range is possible, and none of that is something that Obama can hang his hat on and say, you know, see, I told you we were going to have this great growth. So I think those numbers are coming out. They came from a number where, if you remember the previous month, the unemployment rate dropped to 7.8%. Controversial comments by Jack Welch, the former chairman of GE, saying that these were manipulated numbers. There's no evidence of that. But there were seasonal factors like teachers going back to work the end of summer that make September a volatile month, and we're likely to see numbers that we might actually see weak hiring and a tick up in the unemployment rate, which would be tough for Obama days before an election.
Earlier we talked about consumer spending and home construction. I understand defense spending also played a role in the growth numbers. Is that something that was scheduled to happen? Will it continue to happen as time goes on?
Unlikely to continue to happen when you think about what the fiscal cliff is all about, the need to double down and cut spending and the threat of sequestered cuts that would come deep into defense. Defense had been lagging the last three quarters, and this was some catch-up, and I suspect some of this had to do with the end of fiscal year. You know, our calendar year ends in December, but the government's fiscal year ends in the end of September. So I think some of that in this quarter was probably defense spending to run it through the end of the cycle in the end of the fiscal year. That's unlikely to continue.
And presumably the uncertainty about the fiscal cliff is one of the reasons that businesses are pulling back a bit, as you indicated earlier, whereas consumers are feeling more optimistic.
Yeah, you see this huge disconnect, particularly in the sentiment. Today, the University of Michigan Thomson Reuters polling of survey of consumer sentiment hit a five-year high. It hasn't been, the consumers haven't been this upbeat since September 2007. Yet at the same time, you've got the National Association of Manufacturers coming out with a report today saying a million jobs have already been lost or not added as a result of the coming fiscal cliff, and I think the numbers are as high as 6 million. Okay. I think for your listeners, I think that's so important to remember about the fiscal cliff is if there isn't an economist out there who doesn't think we'll go into recession if, in fact, they can't get their act together and they push us over the cliff. And that when you come into a recession as weak as we've been for so long, it's going to be hard to come out of.
Kevin Hall with the McClatchy Newspapers, many thanks. We'll be right back with To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Both parties agree that the 2012 presidential election is going down to the wire. The tiny percentage of voters still undecided are predominantly white, non-college-educated women who are the fastest-growing part of a changing workforce. During the second debate, President Obama emphasized that the first bill he signed as president was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which makes it easier for working women to challenge gender discrimination.
And that's an example of the kind of advocacy that we need because women are increasingly the breadwinners in the family. This is not just a women's issue. This is a family issue. There's a middle class issue. And that's why we've got to fight for it.
In response, Mitt Romney spoke to women struggling to work and raise children at the same time.
What we can do to help young women and women of all ages is to have a strong economy, so strong that employers are looking to find good employees and bringing them into their workforce and adapting to a flexible work schedule that gives women the opportunities that they would otherwise not be able to afford. This is what I've done. It's what I look forward to doing. And I know what it takes to make an economy work.
Again, those comments came from the second presidential debate. Since then, the undecided women have become even more the focus of both campaigns. Catherine Seeley reported on the women's vote yesterday in the New York Times in an article headlined, "Crucial Subset, Female Voters Still Deciding." Kit Seeley, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Why is it that female voters are the ones who are late to decide?
Men describe it differently from women. Women would say it's because women are more thoughtful, more open-minded. Men might say women are fickle. But either way, they do tend to take longer to make up their minds. They're more open to new information. And that's the important thing, and that's why not only they're undecided, but that's why both candidates are targeting them, because these are the people who are still open to new information.
Now, I take it this has been true in past elections as well as this one, but the particular cohort of the women's bloc, if there is such a thing as a women's bloc, is what they're focused on now, and it seems to have changed.
That's right. There are, well, they've been given different names by people who want to make it catchy and sort of understandable to the rest of us. The cohort that we're talking about in this case, the so-called waitress moms, have been a defined group for some period of time, and that is white, blue-collar women who did not attend college. And all of those subsets taken together make up the so-called waitress mom. In earlier days, there were soccer moms and security moms, but in those cases, they didn't really stick within those defined demographics. So they were somewhat different people, and they weren't quite as focused on by researchers as the waitress moms are now.
But soccer mom certainly became a famous phrase in the 1990s, a more prosperous time than we have now. And I guess security moms came around after September 11th.
Correct. It's kind of fun to have labels, and it makes people, it's easier than saying white, blue-collar women who didn't attend college. And a phrase like soccer moms really captures what the group is, but that faded out fairly quickly, and waitress moms is the new vogue. But for, I'd say, since 1980 or so, the pollsters have been tracking this particular demographic with these particular overlays.
What does it appear that the waitress moms, and obviously not all of them are waitresses, want to hear from the candidates?
Well, I think they want to figure out how they can make their lives better. The more abstract issues that were discussed in the first debate left a lot of them cold, according to numerous focus groups and Dial research groups. They wanted to hear more about their own lives and their own issues and how the new economy was actually going to produce a job for them or their husband or their children, hear more about so-called women's issues, Planned Parenthood. And as you played in the clip from Mitt Romney, his idea of helping women is a strong economy overall. They want to hear specifics about the economy and how that's going to improve their lives, because these are the people who are really in the crunch, who just they're sort of spinning in the hamster cage. They've got demands from children, taxes, schools, all kinds of pressures, and they're not getting the kind of pensions or 401ks or other kind of retirement benefits out there. So they really need specifics in the here and now.
Kit Seeley again with the New York Times, her recent article, Crucial Subset, Female Voters Still Deciding. That was in the paper yesterday. Margie O'Meara is president and founder of Momentum Analysis. That's a Democratic public opinion research firm that got together with a Republican firm, Public Opinion Strategies, to study Walmart moms as a separate voting bloc, going back to 2010. Margie O'Meara, good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me.
How come you got together with the Republicans to talk about Walmart moms?
Well, it's a bipartisan project, and we're really trying to give voice to this group of the population. It's about 15% of the electorate. We define them as women with kids under 18 living at home who have shopped at a Walmart at least once in the last month, and they come from a wide variety of socioeconomic backgrounds across race and ethnicity, across the country, and party and ideology groupings. And we found them to be proven swing voters. In 2008, they voted for Obama. In the beginning of 2010, they were a little bit more swing. By November 2010, they voted more decidedly Republican. 2011, they were back in the middle a little bit, and we're going to see how they vote this time around.
How can you call them a single vote if, in fact, or a group, rather, if they differ so much in race, ethnicity, and even in income?
Well, we don't call them a single group, but we do notice, though, a few patterns that are particularly important. The first is, compared to voters overall, they're particularly interested in their household economy. So in 2011, we asked Walmart moms, are you more concerned about your household finances or the national economy? And 2-1, Walmart mom said, I'm more concerned about my household finances. Voters overall are more evenly divided, and it's something that makes sense when we see how many different things moms have to do. It doesn't really matter whether they're married or they're not married, or whether they're college educated or not college educated. Moms bear the brunt of household tasks. They make the doctor's appointments. They are worried about schools. They're worried about what kind of economy their kids are going to graduate into. And when we do focus groups, so listening to the moms in their own words, some of the folks we talk to say, I'm concerned about funding my 529 for my kids' college fund down the road, or my retirement. And others say, I'm worried about affording gas and strategizing how I'm going to do my grocery shopping so I don't run out of gas, and everything in between. And wherever they are very keenly concerned about their household finances and just struggling to get their whole their house running in order and the finances of the house running in order. And that's the lens through which they view the political debate.
And I take it that this would include waitress moms as well as other moms.
Well, I mean, however waitress moms are defined, we include, all moms with kids under 18 who, it's really a pretty ubiquitous group. And, we found that parental status and the pressure of having kids at home is something that's, pretty unique. So that's how we've looked at it. I haven't seen data about soccer moms or waitress moms, but certainly across the socioeconomic groupings, women are concerned about their own household finances and which presidential candidate is really going to be addressing those concerns.
Should point out that Walmart, I take it, paid for the research that you and the Republican firm Public Opinion Strategies had both collaborated on. So I take it Walmart wanted a study of its customers.
Well, this actually has our study has had nothing to do with consumer behavior or views toward Walmart or shopping or anything like that. It really is about how these women view the political debate and the intersection of the personal and political. We don't have any questions in there about their consumer behavior or shopping patterns or anything like that.
Well, let me go back to Kit Seeley with the New York Times. Does this sound as if waitress moms would be a subset, to use part of your title in the New York Times, of the overall female voter pattern?
Sure. I think Margie got to that point. Waitress moms certainly are obsessed with, interested in the household economy, in running their households, in making sure their kids are going to be well-educated and, making ends meet. I do think the waitress moms are, it's probably a smaller subset of women than Walmart moms, because Walmart moms takes in people with college educations and higher incomes. You know, they're a much broader group. So, yeah, waitress moms would be a subset.
Margie O'Meara, back to you with momentum analysis. How do these women feel if household concerns are their principal worry? How do they feel about the issues that have been so prominent of late and in the campaign, abortion and contraception?
Well, it's not their number one vote driver. And that's consistent with what we've seen nationally in polling, among women. Ultimately, it's not the number one vote driver. That said, it does come up. I mean, I won't say it doesn't come up. And my sense is that Walmart moms, like women overall, lean left on that. Nonetheless, I think ultimately, though, you know, when we talk about social issues, there are a lot of people, women, Walmart moms, men, Democrats, Republicans, when they see a lot of focus on social issues, feel that that's a sign of Washington that is too focused on partisan bickering and less on the urgency of our economic, national economic situation. That being said, though, I think that ultimately when you see, when you hear like the comments like from Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch in the news, and that dominates the news, I think that's an advantage for the president, a disadvantage for the Romney team. But I think for swing voters, it's not their number one primary concern.
Kit Seeley, what about the waitress moms? Did you find that they were particularly concerned about the social issues?
I found that there was a lot of that they think about abortion and access to birth control as an economic issue, a pocketbook issue, and I think both candidates have been addressing, you know, sort of moving those issues into the economic realm, and I think they are concerned. I think a lot of the women I talked to said they were mostly thinking about access, not only access to birth control, but having that be sort of a signifier, an indication of what of how a candidate might act in other circumstances. That is, if someone, President Obama, for example, supports abortion rights and wants women to have access to contraceptives, that's a real signifier to them that, okay, he cares about me, and he's putting this in economic terms, in pocketbook issues, that we know if family planning is that family planning is essential to working out a household budget. You know, if you've got more kids than you planned on, then that's going to impinge on your financial stability. So I think it is an issue. I agree with Margie that from what I heard from women I talked to in New Hampshire, it's not the foremost issue. It's not the top. The top is the economy, but it's wrapped up in the economy.
Okay, but Margie O'Meara, there is a relationship, I take it then, between these two things.
Well, yeah, certainly. I think there are a few things to point out. One, I agree with what Kit was saying, and we've heard it in our focus groups. We've heard respondents say, I want to have another child, but I can't because the economy is not doing well, and we're not doing well. And that's something that is very, very real, you know, real-life decision. It's not simply a talking point. So that's something we've definitely heard. I think that when you have candidates who, you know, when you have candidates like Murdoch and Akin, you know, use language that really, I think to some strikes them as a sign that that they're not really putting themselves in women's shoes.
Okay, hold that thought. We need to take a break. We're going to do that. Kit Seeley, thank you very much for being on our program. We'll come back and continue the conversation with Margie O'Meara and others. This is To the Point from PRI. We'll be right back.
Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To The Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Well, we're only back with To The Point, talking about the very few remaining undecided voters that both candidates are going after, Mitt Romney and President Obama. And we've been hearing about various categories of undecided women, thought principally to be white, non-college-educated, working women, not the soccer moms of the prosperous 1990s. We've heard about the waitress moms, and we've heard about Walmart moms. Will Feltus is a Republican pollster. He's a media researcher and co-author of a forthcoming college textbook, Campaign Manager. Will Feltus, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Book coming out after the election. You're not going to give any secrets away before November the 6th, I take it. Chime in here with what we have been hearing from our other guests about the nature of the undecided votes that these candidates are so very eagerly and energetically courting with all the money that they have in the world.
Well, to go back to the to the issue of the women's vote, one thing you have to remember when you talk about the women's vote, if there is such a thing, is that women are roughly about 10% more Democratic than men in the country. So a lot of what happens with the women's vote is driven by this underlying partisanship. The two things that are most important in predicting how someone will vote are their partisanship and how often they vote. So as a political market researcher, those are the two variables that we key on.
Do women vote more than men?
Marginally, yes, they do. But the difference in turnout is probably not that significant. A lot of that has to do with the racial demographics of women versus male voters. For example, black women will vote at much higher rates than black men.
So what do you tell your Republican colleagues or clients, rather, if, in fact, there is this underlying partisanship, as you call it, with women 10% more Democratic than men?
Well, this is the historic gender gap that we've heard about for years, and I'd be interested in the other guests' thoughts about why women are more Democratic than men. Roughly, it's about 10%. When you get down to the kind of groups that Kit was talking about, blue-collar women without college educations, that gap very much widens. So women who don't have a college education and who are blue-collar are about 20% more Democratic than their male counterparts. So I think that in terms of targeting a group, a swing group, that will make a difference in the election. Strategically, blue-collar women without college educations, I don't think are really a swing group, but they are very important to President Obama's campaign.
Again, Will Feltus is a Republican pollster and media researcher. Margie O'Meara, let me go back to you, Democratic advisor with Momentum Analysis. What do you say to that? They aren't really a swing group. They're much more likely to go Democratic.
Well, to be sure, women are voting Democratic. There's been a gender gap that's benefited Democratic presidential candidates since 1980. So, I certainly agree with Will on that. And, we have data that shows that the group that we're talking about does swing, and it includes married women as well as unmarried women, or married moms, rather, and unmarried moms. And married women are going to be more Republican than unmarried women. So that's why our group, as we've defined it, does swing back and forth. We have that data backup. I think it's important to think about, I mean, Will raises a good question. Why is it that women are voting more Democratic generally as a whole? And I would say that whether we're talking about unmarried women as a group or moms as a group or blue-collar moms or however we define these different segments of women, from my view, if we are inserting the needs and issues of women into the political debate, and I would argue they should be important to Mitt Romney's campaign too, not just Barack Obama's campaign, then I think that's a good outcome for the country. And I my sense from talking to women is that, because you have women frequently at disadvantage economically for whatever variety of reasons, and feeling that one candidate is or one party is more beholden to you know, special interests or big business, and that those aren't my views. That's what polling shows, that people have those views. That I think that reinforces and magnifies this gender gap, and I think it's something that both campaigns and both parties should really think about, rather than, you know, it's not simply just about slicing and dicing women, but really, you know, finding some common language that brings women into the political debate. I think that's a good goal for both parties to have. It shouldn't be one that's just a Democratic priority. It should be one that's both parties' priorities.
Certainly at the moment, Mr. Romney is, in fact, going after the women's vote, whatever the issues beyond that might be. I want to get another voice into this conversation. Kirsten Swinth is a chair and of the History Department and Associate Professor of History at Fordham University. She focuses on women and work and culture, and she's writing a book called Care and Competition in Post-Industrial America, The Making of the Working Family. Good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here.
Why do you think that women are 10% more Democratic than men generally, and 20% in those in the waitress mom category, as we just heard from Will Feltus?
Well, I think I would echo some of what Margie was saying about the ways that women want to hear issues talked about in the election that speak to those fundamental concerns that both she and Kit were identifying earlier on, that have to do with the household economy, their basic family finances and concerns. And I totally agree that this is something that's good for the country as a whole. And the more that both campaigns can speak about it, I think the more that they can draw the attention of women voters.
Rather than focusing on politics, I know, you want to talk in broader terms. And tell us a bit about the what you refer to as a revolution in women's labor patterns. That certainly goes to the question of the waitress moms and the soccer moms. What's happening, and over how long a period has it been happening?
Yeah, so women are really at the front lines of a long-term change in our economy and society. Over the last 50 years, there's been a kind of revolutionary turn to paid labor by women, particularly by married women with children. And that has gone hand-in-hand with the rise of a new post-industrial economy. So we've had this new service economy, we have a new pattern of family labor, and women have been at the vanguard of those changes. So I think they are the sort of front lines, and they know what the impact of those changes have meant on a day-to-day basis in families and social relations and trying to negotiate workplaces.
Let me go back to Will Feltus. Again, you advise Republicans. Have they been taking these issues seriously? Are they addressing the concerns of these people who are on the front lines, as Professor Swinth puts it?
Well, I think they do. I think Democrats and Republicans campaign differently for the women's vote. I think Democrats create the women's vote category and then run communications directed at it. I think Republicans are less likely to do that. So I'm less likely to hear from a client asking me, how do I reach women? We tend to go with the same message we have for men to women. They want to know, they do want to know where the women stand in terms of their political leanings this year.
So Republicans, for example, have opposed the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which the president, we heard earlier in the program, boasting about having signed, the first thing that he signed. Will Feltus, why are they against it if it gives women a greater opportunity to challenge discrimination in the workplace, particularly with regard to equal pay?
Warren, I don't know why they're against it. I don't do policy.
Oh, okay.
I just do marketing. But I mean, personally, I'm against the government telling me what I have to do. I think that's generally a Republican approach. So I think you may get pushback from Republicans because we're tired of the government telling us to do this and do that, and that's the Republican way.
I don't want to get bogged down in this one issue, but Margie O'Meara, I know that at least some Republicans, including one of the senators from Florida, has said that it's a way to keep lawyers in business more than anything else. So does it work well, do you think, for a Democratic women, or are they more open-minded to a discussion about it? I'm sorry, Marjorie O'Meara is gone. I didn't realize that. Let me go back to Kristen Smith then, and let's talk in broader terms about what we're seeing here in terms of women in the workforce and their role in the economy. Among the things you found is that they are in the 10 lowest paid occupations, going back to the issue of the Ledbetter Act. Tell us more about that.
Well, yes, women occupy the 10, out-occupy men in the 10 lowest earning categories, and that's a long-term pattern of historic segregation of men and women in the labor force, where women have historically had over-occupied, been a higher percentage in occupations that with low pay. And the ramifications of that have only been exacerbated by the growth in the service economy, by the expansion of women's labor force participation, so that in the bottom 20%, the lowest households, the kind of waitress mom type household, 7 out of 10 mothers out-earn their husbands. So their sort of basic earning power is really fundamental to their family's well-being, fundamental to their family's economic well-being, fundamental to their families being able to sustain manageable lives. And I think I want to really reiterate points that were being made earlier, that money is just kind of the tip of the iceberg that, about what women want to hear, I think. I think they want to hear about how there can be jobs that make sustainable lives, jobs where they can earn enough money so they don't have to work so many hours that they can't take care of their children, or jobs where they can take time off if they have a sick child, jobs that sort of match the realities of all families today, where people are in the workforce, whether they're men or women, they have family responsibilities, and they need an economy that functions on those terms.
So the economy then becomes the major issue. What about their views on the social issues?
Well, undoubtedly, social issues matter, and certainly I have these conversations with the young women in my classrooms where, you know, it's clear to me that they care about things like reproductive rights and that they see that as basic to their equity. But these women, these college women, still understand that their economic well-being is at the core of their future well-being. So when they get to choose to write their own papers where they get to invent policy solutions to the key problem of the day, I get an onslaught of papers about how to close the gender pay gap, and then relatively fewer about these social issues like abortion and reproductive rights. So it's clearly at the forefront of their minds.
Will Feltus, back to you. What about the statements we've heard recently from candidates for the Senate? So much publicity has been given to them about rape and abortion. Two candidates have come out and said that they don't want to see abortion even in cases of rape, given different reasons. That appears to be the view of the vice presidential candidate, but not Mr. Romney himself, at least at the moment. Is that damaging to the Republicans, do you think, in their effort to seek the women's vote?
I'm sure it is damaging. I don't know why people inject those issues into political campaigns, but it is damaging. And I think that Americans are not focused so much on social issues. Social issues are definitely, as we've heard today, you know, a secondary or tertiary concern to most voters. And women voters are most interested in the economy, their families, their lives, their careers, and that's what Republicans should be talking about, not about social issues.
But it has been Republicans who have injected those issues into the campaigns.
I think there's been a lot of injection from both sides.
So, again, Professor Swinth, you think that do you agree with what we heard from Margie O'Meara earlier, and I believe from Kit Seeley as well, that women see these reproductive issues as economic issues as well as moral ones?
Yes, I do think they see them as economic issues as much as moral issues. And again, I want to reiterate that they do see them as the kind of sign, in the way that Kit Seeley was talking about before, of a statement about commitment to women's rights. But beyond that, they see these sort of social issues around birth control and abortion and reproductive rights as linked to their abilities to plan for, to envision sustainable lives that where they're working, where they're having partners, where they're raising children. They see them in a more integrated way than as a kind of either or, either the economy or social issues. Rather, they're interconnected with each other.
Will Feltes, why do you think it is that women whom you say are 10 or even 20% more Democratic than men moved in the direction of Mitt Romney, bringing the women's vote, according to many polls, virtually even? Why did that happen this year?
I think they're looking for something different. I think that they have a middle-class, blue-collar, non-college-educated person that probably has a higher anxiety level about the economy, and I think that's why they're taking another look at Romney. Whether or not they end up actually voting for him, we don't know. I think we talk about the undecided vote, but what I've seen in research, longitudinal studies where you interview the same person over and over, is that people change their minds a lot during an election. I mean, so you have the undecided vote, and then you maybe have the redecided vote, people who are switching back and forth. I think ultimately a lot of people who can't make up their minds won't vote.
Isn't there research that shows that increasingly, as the country becomes more evenly divided, people do vote for the party rather than necessarily knowing what the issues are? Other pollsters have told us that on this program.
Well, the best predictor of how someone's going to vote is their partisanship. I think America's always been that way. I think the country has become less of a straight ticket voting country in the last 40 or 50 years. As education levels go up, people are less likely to be straight partisans. So I think you do have a lot of ticket splitters, people who will vote for president for one party, for Senate for another party. That's the real key swing, the swing voter, the ticket splitter, the person who will vote on the same ballot for Republicans and Democrats. Those people are the key to elections in America.
And is that likely to be more women or more men?
I have no data on that. All I know is that women are more Democratic. I have no data that shows that women are more likely to pull a straight party lever than men. So I couldn't say. I think that women, you know, it's very hard. We went in the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about Walmart moms and soccer moms. It's very hard to put a label on these kind of groups we're talking about, because I've tried to do it. And I even tried a coupon moms, women who've used a coupon three or more times in the past month. But that doesn't work either. So I think it's important to keep in mind as we talk about these labels on women, and I think we need more labels for men, by the way, to keep in mind as we put these labels on women, that what's really going on underneath the surface is some underlying partisanship, and more importantly, their interest in politics. how likely are men or women to participate in the process?
Okay, that's all the time we have. I'm sorry to say, Will Feltus, Republican pollster, upcoming book, A Campaign Manager, Kirsten Swinth, chair and associate professor of history at the Fordham University, her upcoming book, Care and Competition in Post-Industrial America, The Making of the Working Family. Thanks also to Margie O'Mara with Momentum Analysis and Kit Seeley with The New York Times. Good to have all of you with us, and thanks very much for joining us. Since the start of the U.S. auto industry, manufacturers have granted the right to sell vehicles to new car franchisers. State laws now require in many places that car makers must franchise retail sales to somebody else. But a tiny new maker of an electric car is challenging that system, and the automakers are fighting back. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Elon Musk founded PayPal, and he's the first to launch private missions to the International Space Station. He also makes the Tesla. That's the sleek, expensive last word in electric cars. But instead of using the traditional dealership system, he is setting up his own stores to sell the Tesla. Auto dealers and regional associations have now brought suit. Jerry Hirsch reports on the auto industry for the Los Angeles Times. And Jerry, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren. Glad to be here.
I don't think a lot of people realize how rigid this system of franchising really is and how it's enshrined in the law. Tell us about it.
Well, it arrived with good reason. You know, back 100 years ago at the dawn of the auto industry, there were just hundreds of automakers in the U.S., and they all wanted to get their products in front of people in far-off cities, other places. There are even situations where some manufacturers would build chassis and motors in the car. They'd send it onto a coach builder to put the top on it. One way to do this, if you were making cars in Detroit and you wanted to sell them in Los Angeles, was to license somebody to sell your vehicles. That way you had a retail specialist in L.A. to do it for you. So that grew, and it helped grow distribution of autos across the United States. But then the dealers, the guys who held these licenses, said, wait a minute, what would happen if automakers tried to open their own stores next to us? We'd go out of business. It's just like in the fast food business, you don't see two McDonald's franchises competing next to each other or in real close proximity. There are rules about how far apart they can be. So the states started passing laws to protect the dealers who invested money, capital, and marketing into the business so they couldn't get poached or bigfooted by the manufacturer. Now the dealers have taken it another step. Like in the state of Texas, if you're an automaker, you can't open your own store. In California, you can't open your own store within 10 miles of another franchise. So there's very restrictive rules about this.
It seems to me now with much fewer automakers that this does not necessarily work in favor of consumers because you've got to pay a chunk of the money to the dealer who doesn't make the car.
There's a lot of argument about that. That's a real common view. And, of course, the dealers would argue that, well, we're there for the consumer when there's a recall, when they need their car repaired. You know, we're there to inspect the car and do all these things. Of course, I'm sure Tesla is going to do that exact same thing at its stores, too. I mean, if there's a problem with a car, this is a $100,000 vehicle, they're going to take care of it. There's also a question about who saves money on this. If you're buying directly from the automaker, okay, maybe the automaker makes the profit that the dealer would have gotten otherwise. It also might be that if you're a really good negotiator, you can get a better deal from a specific dealer. It's really hard to know how this might map out if it became the custom.
Do you think Tesla is going to be able to get away with this? Elon Musk is a multi-billionaire. He has a lot of resources. But, of course, in terms of the auto industry, Tesla is tiny.
Well, the attorneys who I have talked to about that, these are people who are experts in dealership law and even have defended dealers in lawsuits with the automakers, say that in most states, if you're a brand new company and you don't have franchises anywhere, you can open your own store. And it's going to be very hard for the dealers in most states to block that. Texas is an exception. There might be some other exceptions. And we're going to see the case law develop now as these suits get heard. There's one in Massachusetts where the dealers there are seeking an injunction to shutter a Tesla store. And a judge heard the case yesterday and has it under submission. And we should hear probably next week a decision in that case.
But that would apply only to Massachusetts, of course.
Right,
there's
just
nothing
to the
general.
Area.
So this for Tesla, then, even though he's not selling that many cars, and they're all pretty expensive and not that easy for ordinary people to get, he might have to deal with lawsuits in numerous states, I take it.
Yeah, and since you know the dealers, there's a big National Auto Dealers Association. It would be probably a good strategy on their part to try to slow Tesla down by litigating in many different locales and creating expense for the company.
In the meantime, Tesla says that electric cars are special. They're somehow different. Is he going to be able to get anywhere with that?
Well, Elon's argument is that virtually every auto dealer in the United States is set up with one purpose, to sell a car that's powered by gasoline. And there's a conflict at the heart of selling cars between gasoline and electricity. This is what Elon would argue. He would say that, you know, if your whole business model is oriented to gasoline, you're not going to give the electric vehicle a fair shake. My guess is that Nissan is working really hard to sell the Leaf, and that's an electric car, and its dealers are probably working to sell it. So I don't know that holds up.
All right. We will see, though, if the electric car business does, in fact, change the way cars are sold in the United States. Jerry Hirsch with the Los Angeles Times, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Evan George, Anna Scott, Caitlin Schamberg, Technical Director Mike Newport, Managing Producer Sonia Geis. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. I'm Orman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.